really good to have you with us. Now, we've got a bit of a mix of people here. We had William Craig up this morning at 10:30, but we've also got some people back with us for the first, or with us for the first time. So can we just hear a little bit about yourself? Where are you from?
Well, we're Americans. Jan and I are here on a three-week speaking trip to various universities in four cities of Australia. I'm affiliated with Talbot School of Theology in Southern California. I'm a research professor of philosophy there.
Okay. Now, you defend the things of Jesus and Christianity, the Christian faith. When did you actually start looking into these things for the first time yourself?
I wasn't raised in a Christian home or even a church-going family. But when I became a teenager, I began to ask what I call the big questions in life. Who am I? Why am I here? Where am I going? And in the search for answers, I began to attend all by myself a church in our community. Only problem was, instead of answers, all I found was a sort of social country club where the dues were a dollar a week in the offering plate. And the other students in the youth group who pretended to be such good Christians on Sunday lived for their real God the rest of the week, which was popularity. And this really bothered me because I thought, here I am, so spiritually empty inside, and yet externally, I'm leading a better life than they are. And they claim to be Christians. They're all just a bunch of hypocrites. And so I began to become very angry with the church and the people in it because of the phoniness and the hypocrisy that I saw. And pretty soon this attitude spread toward other people as well. Everybody, I thought, is a phony and a hypocrite. They're all putting up plastic masks to the world, and the real person is cowering down inside, afraid to come out and be real. And so I said, I don't need other people. I hate people. I don't want anything to do with them. And I threw myself into my studies and shunned relationships with other people. And I was on my way, frankly, toward becoming a very alienated young man. And yet, in moments of honesty and introspection, when I looked into my own heart, I knew that deep down inside, I really did want to love and to be loved by others. And I realized in that moment that I was just as much a phony as they were, because here I was pretending not to need people, and yet deep down inside, I knew I really did. And so that anger that I felt to them, toward them, turned in on myself because of my own hypocrisy and phoniness. And I don't know if you understand what this kind of anger is like, but it just eats away at your insides every day, day after day, making every day miserable, another day to get through. And I remember one day I walked into my high school German class and I was feeling particularly crummy. And I sat down behind a girl who is one of these types that is always so happy that it just makes you sick. And I tapped her on the shoulder and she turned around and I said to her, Sandy, what are you always so happy about anyway? And she said, well, Bill, it's because I'm saved. And I said, you're what? And she said, I know Jesus Christ is my personal savior. And I said, well, I go to church. And she said, that's not enough, Bill. You've got to have him really living in your heart. And I said, well, what would he want to do a thing like that for? And she said, because he loves you, Bill. And that just hit me like a ton of bricks. Here I was so filled with anger and hate. And she said that there was someone who really loved me. And who was it but the God of the universe? And that thought just staggered me, to think that the God of the universe could love that worm named Bill Craig down there on that speck of dust called planet Earth. And I just couldn't take it in. And I went home that night and I found a New Testament that had been given to me in the fifth grade by the Gideons who had visited our grade school. I'd never opened it before, but now I opened it and began to read it. And as I did, I was absolutely captivated by the person of Jesus of Nazareth. There was a ring of truth about this man's words, and there was an authenticity about his life that wasn't characteristic of these people that claimed to be his followers in this local church I was going to. And I knew then I couldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater. And as I read the New Testament, I realized why God seemed so unreal to me. It was because my own sin and wrongdoing had created a separation between me and God, so that the relationship with God that I was created to have was ruptured, and I was alienated from God, guilty before him and needing his forgiveness, and that God had sent Christ to die for my sins, to forgive me and restore me to the relationship that he created me to have. And Sandy introduced me to other Christians in the high school. I didn't even know people like this existed. It was as if they were in touch with a different plane of reality than I was, a reality that I had no contact with, but it filled their lives with a deep peace and meaning and joy that I craved. Well, to make a long story short, after about 6 months of the most intense soul-searching I've ever been through in my life, I just came to the end of my rope, and I cried out to God, and I cried out all the anger and the bitterness that was inside of me, and at the same time, I felt this tremendous infusion of joy, like a balloon being blown up until it was ready to pop, and I rushed outdoors, and I remember it was a warm Midwestern summer evening. And as I looked up at the sky, I could see the Milky Way from horizon to horizon. And as I looked at the stars, I thought, God, I've come to know God. And this moment revolutionized my whole life, because I had thought enough about this during those 6 months to realize that if this were really the truth, if it were really the truth, then I could do nothing else than devote my entire life to spreading this message among mankind, because this is the greatest news ever announced. And so that's basically why we're here in Australia, because I love to share the good news of this message, especially with university students who are about the same age that I was when Christ turned my life upside down.
Mm, that's awesome. Thank you for sharing some of that with us. Now, we're going to hear some a lot more from you, but let me just point you to that phone number that's on the screen there. The way that we're going to try and pull this off is if you can text in your question, we'll kind of try and sort that and try and get that out there. I can't promise we'll get to all of those questions, but that's the number to send them to. They're going to pop up on the screen I've got here. And we've also got some questions kind of carrying on from this morning, which we'll get to. But can you just tell us, what are the fields, the disciplines that you have studied in? You said you threw yourself
All right.
into it.
I have earned doctorates in two fields, philosophy and theology. In philosophy, I have made it my life's work to do a philosophical analysis of the principal attributes of God. And so I have invested years of study in things like God's omniscience, which means God's being all-knowing, in God's eternity, which is God's property of being everlasting, and trying to understand God's relationship with time. For the last 10 years or so, I've been studying divine aseity, which is the property of God's self-existence. And this has taken me into collateral areas like the philosophy of space and time, contemporary cosmology and relativity theory, philosophy of mathematics, philosophy of language. One of the exciting things about doing philosophy of religion, which is my specialization, is that it's like the hub of a wheel, and the spokes go out and touch every other area of philosophy. And so those are some of the areas that I've worked in. In the area of system of theology, my primary interest there was in the historicity of the resurrection of Jesus. The German government funded me for 2 years to study the historicity of Jesus' resurrection. And this is a continuing area of interest, as well as the broad project of Christian theology and trying to develop an integrative worldview where theology takes cognizance of the best findings in secular disciplines to create a coherent Christian worldview.
Well, let's start with a question on the resurrection, because at the moment, as a church, we're actually speaking to our community and asking the question, who do you think Jesus is? And so we want to have a conversation with the community. We also then want to take the answers, responses they are giving and speak to them in a series in January. And so we get a range of responses, but one of them is, you know, a guy who lived 2,000 years ago, something about dying, and that's about it.
Yeah.
But of course, the claims of Christianity include that, but that this dead man came back to life. How can a thinking person actually believe the resurrection as we find in the Gospels? What are the evidences for
that? Let me pick up on something that you said, that this happened 2,000 years ago. I think it's very important to understand that what's important is not the time gap between when the event occurred and today. What's important is the time gap between when the event occurred and when the evidence for that event occurred. And if that gap is very narrow, then it doesn't matter whether it's 2,000 years in the past, 1,000 years in the past, or whatever. Good evidence doesn't become bad evidence just because of the passage of time. And one of the exciting things about New Testament studies today is that it is appreciating how close the sources for the life of Jesus are to the events that they actually record in a way that has few parallels in ancient history. For example, our earliest biographies of the great Alexander, the Alexander the Great, the Greek general, come from Arrian and Plutarch 400 years after Alexander's death. And yet classical historians regard these as largely reliable accounts of the life of Alexander the Great. By contrast, our documents for the life of Jesus come from within the first generation after Jesus, while the eyewitnesses were still alive and around. So these are really very good historical sources for the knowledge of Jesus' resurrection. Now you ask, well, how can someone believe in something like this? I think this all depends upon whether or not you believe in God.
Can I just pause you?
Yeah.
What are those documents that we have? What are the sources that were written close to
the primary source documents would be the four Gospels, which are biographies, really, of Jesus, of Nazareth, which is in itself exceptional. There's very few figures in ancient history for which you would have four biographies. So we've got these four biographies. And then we have the letters of the New Testament, like the letters of Paul, for example, which are extremely early. And then the Acts of the Apostles, which includes a lot of the sermons of these early preachers of the Gospels as they traveled around the Mediterranean. So we have a number of sources that the church later collected into the New Testament. There are other sources outside the New Testament, Roman, Christian, and Jewish sources, but these tend to be later than the New Testament documents and derivative. They know the New Testament documents and therefore really aren't independent. And so the primary sources will be these early Greek documents that later got collected into the New Testament.
That's good. And they all speak about a resurrection. So
right, and that's important. It's universal. The belief that Jesus is risen from the dead isn't the conviction of some peculiar offshoot or branch of Christianity. This was the universal conviction of this early Jesus movement that followed his death. And that's a remarkable fact when you think about it. One of the things the historian has to explain is how this movement got going. Jesus' crucifixion should have spelled the end of any hopes his followers might have entertained that he was the Messiah, because the Messiah, in Jewish thinking, was supposed to be a military king who would restore the throne of David in Jerusalem, cast off Israel's enemies, and in the first century that meant Rome, and command the respect of Jew and Gentile alike. A Messiah who got himself crucified, who was humiliatingly executed as a common criminal by his enemies who failed to deliver and reign, was simply a contradiction in terms. So the historian, one of the facts he has to explain is, what in the world got this movement going in the middle of the first century following Jesus' crucifixion, which was founded upon the belief that God had raised him from the dead?
Now, this morning you took us through four evidences for the resurrection. Can you take us through those briefly?
Let me expand that to five, since we have a little bit more time. There are five established facts about what happened to Jesus of Nazareth that are recognized by the wide majority of New Testament historians today. One is that Jesus of Nazareth died of crucifixion at the hands of the Roman government under Pontius Pilate in Palestine. Second, that his corpse was then interred in a tomb by a member of the Jewish high court, the Sanhedrin. And we actually know this man's name, astonishingly. His name was Joseph of Arimathea. Thirdly, that tomb was then discovered empty on the Sunday morning following the crucifixion by a small group of Jesus' women followers. Fourth, thereafter, various individuals and groups of people, under a variety of circumstances and at different locales, experienced appearances of Jesus alive. And finally, the original disciples suddenly and sincerely came to believe that God had raised Jesus of Nazareth from the dead, despite every predisposition to the contrary. Now, those are the facts that I think are well established. So the only question is, how do you best explain them? What is the best account of those four facts? Or five facts in this case.
Yeah, and just on that fifth one, what was the change that happened in these disciples?
Good question. The great British biblical historian N.T. Wright refers to this change as a mutation in Jewish thinking that was involved in early Christianity. And this mutation was primarily twofold. First of all, they believed that Jesus was risen from the dead apart from and in advance of the general resurrection at the end of the world. For Judaism, the resurrection from the dead was always a resurrection on the judgment day, at the end of the world. The idea of a resurrection within history is unknown in antecedent Judaism. And also, the resurrection was always a corporate event. It was all the righteous dead or all the people that would be raised from the dead on the judgment day by God, but never an isolated individual. Second mutation was the connection of the resurrection with the Messiah. There's nothing in antecedent Judaism that connects Messiah with being raised from the dead. And yet, in early Christianity, they believed that God had raised Jesus from the dead and that this showed him to be Messiah after all, despite his crucifixion. So one of the challenges facing the historian is how to explain these mutations. Something must have happened, something very dramatic, caused these Jewish men and women to adopt a view that was just totally contrary to the Judaism in which they were raised and nurtured. And the question is, what was that thing? How do you explain this?
Got a question here. How do you explain the differences in the resurrection accounts between the four Gospels?
Yes.
And I guess from that, even differences beyond the resurrection within those
four sources. And my answer will deal with the more general question. In the morning service today, I dealt with this at greater length, and I'm sure there must have been a recording made of that service that folks could listen to, but let me get a short answer here. I think that these differences can be explained as either due to different sources that the different gospel writers used. In other words, Mark used one source, Luke used not only Mark, but another source in writing his narratives, and so these sources would give different accounts. Or you could say that these were stories that were orally transmitted. And in the transmission of oral tradition, what's important is that you get the core of the story right, the central facts. But then the storyteller can feel free to tell the secondary and circumstantial details in a different way. And so in either of these cases, you would have differences in the circumstantial and secondary details of the narrative, but the core would be fixed and constant.
Similar theme, I guess, in terms of the Gospels. Why are there some Gospels that are in the New Testament and others that are not?
Basically, it's a matter of their provenance. Now, what do I mean by that? What I mean is where they came from and when they were written. The four Gospels were all written within the lifetime of the eyewitnesses and were associated with the original apostles who followed Jesus, or in the case of Luke, who traveled with Paul and was intimately acquainted with them. These four Gospels were, from the first century, recognized as everyone, by everyone, as being the sources that gave us the biography of Jesus of Nazareth. It's not as though the church chose to adopt these four Gospels. These four Gospels imposed themselves on the church because everybody knew these were the primary accounts. No apocryphal gospel arose during the first century. The apocryphal gospels were forgeries under the apostles' names, which did not appear until the second half of the second century after Christ, from AD 150 on into the 200s, the 300s, and so forth. And everybody knew they were fakes. The apostles had long died off by then. So you've got things like the Gospel of Peter, the Gospel of Thomas, the Gospel of Bartholomew, and the church didn't put these in the New Testament because everybody knew these were forgeries. In fact, what they were really documents that, for example, Gnostics were using to use Jesus as a kind of mouthpiece for their own doctrines. Gnosticism is a Greek philosophy that thinks of the spiritual realm as good and the material realm as evil. And these Gnostics used these stories about Jesus just to have him be the mouthpiece that would spew out Gnostic doctrine. But they weren't really Christians. And the church knew these were fakes and condemned them.
It's good. I'm seeing the questions coming in, which is great. I'm just trying to categorize them before we move on. So how do you explain miracles? I know that came up this morning, but that's a response we're getting as we speak to the community. Yeah. Oh, a guy who apparently did some pretty weird stuff.
Well, to me, as a philosopher, once you believe in the existence of God, miracles just aren't a problem. I don't even understand what the problem is if you think God exists, because if there is a creator of the universe who designed all of the laws of nature, then the odd resurrection is just child's play. So I guess I think it all depends. Do you believe in God? If you don't believe in God, well, then, of course, miracles are impossible. But if you do believe that God exists, then miracles ought not to trouble you. At least their possibility. Identifying a miracle will still be difficult. That will still be an open question. Was this a miracle? Was this cancer, say, miraculously healed? Or was it just a spontaneous remission? That question, of course, remains open. But there isn't any philosophical problem about miracles, it seems to me, if you believe in God.
Well, on that point, there's a question here. In your opinion, what is the best argument for atheism, and what would your response to that argument be?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think probably the best argument for atheism would be what philosophers call the hiddenness of God, namely the idea that God's existence could be so much more obvious if he wanted it to be, and yet God seems so hidden. And indeed, in some cases, he seems strangely silent. When we're going through difficult times and our prayers aren't answered and he seems not to be there, and the suspicion may arise, well, maybe he's not there. Maybe God doesn't really exist. So the hiddenness of God is a problem, I think. Now, in terms of my response to this, I guess I would say a number of things. One is that I think God has given adequate evidence of himself for those who are willing to look at it with an open mind. And as I said in the morning service, it's not coercive. It's not going to compel someone whose mind is closed. But there's no reason God would want to give coercive evidence. What he wants to give is evidence of his existence that is available to those who honestly seek him. And this includes things like the origin of the universe, out of nothing at a point in the finite past, the incredible fine-tuning of the universe for intelligent life, not to mention the evolution of biological complexity in the existence of mind in the universe, the existence of a realm of objective moral values and duties, which seems to require God as their foundation. The applicability of mathematics to the physical world is best explained by there being a God who has created the physical world on this mathematical structure. I already mentioned the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus, and then the personal experience of God as well. And so in all of these ways, I think that God has given evidence of his existence that is sufficient for those with an open mind and an open heart. And when we go through difficult times, I think that's when, as the book of Job teaches, we are required to trust in God as he takes us through those hard times with faith that ultimately his purposes will be achieved. And this isn't a blind faith or an irrational faith. There are good reasons to believe this, such as I just laid out. But there will be times when we're called upon to pass through the dark valley, and we can trust God to see us through that if we will follow him in faith and in confidence in his reality.
Now, you mentioned earlier in your own story something about sin and standing before this God guilty. There's a question here that says, if God knew the world was going to fall into evil, was it cruel to create it in the first place?
This is a really good question. And as I've thought about it, this is what it seems to me. I think that God wants every human being to come to know him and to find eternal life and forgiveness of sin. And therefore, God gives sufficient grace for salvation to every single person that he creates. Now, he knew that that meant some would reject his love and grace and separate themselves from him forever. And they do so only by pushing away and refusing God's every effort to save them. They repudiate God's grace and the work of the Holy Spirit in their heart. And God will not force them to repent or have faith. He will try to draw them to himself, but in the final analysis, God respects our decision whether we want to come to him or push him away. He knew that many would push him away and be lost, and he grieves over that. But he also knew that billions of people would come to embrace him and find eternal life, salvation, and incomprehensible joy in heaven. And the happiness and the blessedness of those who would follow him and believe in him should not be prevented by those who would stubbornly refuse him and resist his every effort to save them. There's no reason to give the lost who freely refuse God veto power over the blessedness and the happiness of those who would believe in him. So it seems to me that so long as God gives sufficient grace to every person that he creates to be saved, he's no less loving for choosing to create a world in which untold numbers come to know him and find salvation, even though he knows that this means that many tragically will freely refuse him and be lost.
There's a theme around a number of questions coming here, and as I speak, particularly with younger people, either those who are unwilling to kind of jump into the things of Jesus, or people who do call themselves Christians but are now unsure when they hear, particularly in the media, evolution. Is to be a Christian someone who has to kind of put a blindfold on as to what is happening in other disciplines, science?
No,
how does a Christian kind of respond, or someone who's looking into these
things? I don't
think
that's that is the case, Jez. And with respect to Genesis chapter 1, where the creation of the world is described, there are any number of interpretations of this chapter which are open to faithful Bible-believing Christians. And the literal interpretation is just one of them. There are many other interpretations as well that I think are equally legitimate, and I would say in some cases more plausible. Now, if you're interested in this, on our website, reasonablefaith.org, I teach a Sunday school class for adults called Defenders. And one of the subsections of our class is on doctrine of creation. And recently, we have completed a long excursus on creation and evolution. And we spent several months talking about, I think, 8 different interpretations of Genesis chapter 1, only one of which was the literal interpretation, what's sometimes called young earth creationism today. And I would invite anyone who's interested in that to listen to that lecture and see the positions that different Bible-believing Christians take on this issue. So I think the Christian can be open-minded, and it's wrong to think that there's only one interpretation that is incumbent upon every Bible-believing Christian.
Does that apply to the story of Noah and the flood? There's a question here saying that was impossible. How could you believe that?
Well, that is another case.
Is it fair, though, to say that is impossible?
It depends, again, on how you interpret it. If you take this to be a universal, worldwide flood, that does seem pretty improbable, scientifically. And therefore, a lot of the folks who defend the historicity of this event take it to be a local flood. In fact, there was recently a very interesting book come out by a couple of secular geologists speculating as to what the deluge of Noah may have been. And their speculation is that before the Black Sea was formed, where the Bosporus Straits are in Turkey, where Istanbul is, that this was originally a kind of land bridge that hemmed in the Mediterranean. And they have suggested there is geological evidence that this at one point then burst and the Mediterranean spilled into the Black Sea basin, forming the Black Sea and inundated this whole area. And they think that could have been Noah's flood. And that there's some evidence that could have happened in that way. Now, I don't know. I've never studied it. I'm a philosopher, not an ancient historian or Old Testament scholar. But I just share that with you to say that this is an issue that's open to discussion and exploration.
A couple of questions on the nature of God. How is it possible that God has existed forever? And in that, usually people are asking who created God.
Well, what I would say is that anything that begins to exist has to have a cause. Things don't come into being out of nothing.
Give us the bang. That was good.
Oh, yeah, in the first talk, I give an example from an atheist philosopher, Kai Nielsen at the University of Calgary. He says, suppose you hear a bang, and you ask me, what caused that bang? And I say, nothing. It just happened. He says, you wouldn't accept that. In fact, you would find my reply quite unintelligible. And my claim is that, just as that's true of the little bang, it's also true of the big bang. If something comes into being, then there needs to be a cause. But if something never came into being, if it is eternal, then it would need to have a cause. In fact, how could it have a cause if it's always been there? It's not as though you can kind of get before it to bring it into existence. It's always been there. So the real question is, how could God have been created if he's eternal? I don't see how he could, and especially if he's timeless, if he's completely outside the dimension of time, well, then he can't be created. So it seems to me that once a person understands the doctrine of divine eternity, which is one of those areas that I worked on that I mentioned, then you see that this question, who caused God, is just easy to answer. Nobody or nothing caused God or even could cause God. He's an eternal being.
There's questions on the multiverse. And can I put that to you as briefly as that, but also can you connect that question to Jesus somehow?
dubiously. But let me...
So we can talk about these things. How would what we do know about Jesus connect to the answer that you might give? I might have to give
it. Yeah, okay. You're going to have to tell me because I don't see the connection. Yeah. But let me just say this. I think as a theist, I'm completely open to the idea of a multiverse. I don't see any reason to think that our universe is the only one God could have created. He may have created other universes as well. What I would say, though, is this, is that the existence of a multiverse doesn't do anything to undermine either the argument for the existence of God based on the beginning of the universe, nor the argument based on the fine-tuning of the universe, as is sometimes thought. Now, why is that? Well, it's because the same evidence that shows that our universe began to exist applies to the multiverse as well. It cannot be eternal in the past, but must have had a beginning. So that means that the multiverse began to exist and then has been chugging out these mini universes ever since that point. As for the fine-tuning, it doesn't eliminate the need for an explanation of the fine-tuning, because although there will be, by chance alone, finely tuned universes in this array of other universes, nevertheless, of that subset that are observable, by far and away, most of those observable universes won't be fine-tuned. For example, the most probable observable universe would be a universe in which a single brain would randomly fluctuate into existence out of the vacuum and observe its otherwise empty world. So if we were just a random member of such a multiverse, we ought to be having observations like that. And since we don't, that strongly disconfirms the multiverse hypothesis. So ironically, I think, the best hope for those who want to believe in a multiverse is theism. I think it's only if you've got God that you have really a plausible chance of saying that he has created a multiverse. Now, how would you connect that with Jesus?
I might throw it into my next question. I guess I was just going to say Jesus came into this world, part of this universe, making claims to the people of this universe.
Yeah, all right, but fair enough. I think that's right. So if there were some other universes, God would have other plans for them.
Sure, that we don't know about.
Right.
But we've got to deal with what we do know.
Right.
And not
the Bible
kind of skirt around
us
with an argument of,
on this planet,
yeah.
And God has no obligation to inform us of what he's doing in some other universe.
So another question on kind of related to that is, so someone looks into, okay, there must be a beginning, a creator, there must be a God. Why is it the God of Jesus Christ?
Right.
And do I need to look into the things of Christianity, but then also Islam and all the other?
I think you should, but let me answer the question directly. Most of the arguments that I give for the existence of God are simply arguments for monotheism. So that would be common to Judaism, Christianity, Islam, deism. There are even some tiny sects of Hinduism that are monotheistic. So what these arguments would exclude would be atheism, agnosticism, and pantheistic religions, which identify the world as divine. Things like most schools of Hinduism, Taoism, Buddhism, and so forth. It will narrow down the world's religions to the great monotheistic faiths. Then the question will be, aha, so which monotheism? Islam? Christianity? Which one? And there I would appeal to the person of Jesus. Jesus claimed to be the absolute revelation of God to mankind. And I think God has vindicated those claims by raising him from the dead, an extraordinary miracle and vindication of those allegedly blasphemous claims for which he was crucified. So if God has raised Jesus from the dead, this is a public, unequivocal vindication of those allegedly blasphemous claims for which he was crucified. And that gives us reason to think that it is Christian monotheism that is true rather than, say, Muslim or just Jewish monotheism.
Now, you're in the country, amongst other things, debating Professor Lawrence Krauss.
Yes.
Who is a physicist.
Yes.
And cosmologist.
Yes, primarily a physicist, okay, rather than a cosmologist.
So we've got a question here, which is saying, Krauss claims that nothing is different to what you define as nothing. Who is right and why? Can you give us a bit of context
right
for what's happening there? That's good.
And I can prove it. I mean, it's just very easy to see. The word nothing in the English...
Sorry, what's the debate here, kind of quickly,
well,
on the nothing issue?
The debate is, why does the universe exist instead of nothing at all? Or why did the universe begin to exist if there was an absolute beginning before which there was nothing?
Right.
And so what Krauss says is physics can explain this. Physics can offer a plausible explanation of why the universe exists rather than nothing. Now, the word nothing in the English language is a term of universal negation. It means not anything. There's a whole series of words like this in English. Nowhere means not anywhere. No one means not anyone. Nobody means not anybody. These are terms of universal negation, meaning not any whatever. It is a misuse of these terms to take them as terms of reference, referring to something. So, for example, if I say to you, what did you have for lunch today? And you say, I had nothing for lunch. It would be inept for me to say, well, then how did it taste? That would take it as a term of reference rather than saying, I did not have anything for lunch. If you read in a history book that nothing stopped the German advance from sweeping across Belgium, it would be inept to say, oh, I'm glad it was stopped. Nothing stopped it, and I'm so glad that it did so. It means it was not stopped by anything. So what Krauss does, incredibly, though his mother tongue is English, takes the word nothing to be a term of reference referring to something, namely things like the quantum vacuum, which is empty space filled with energy. It is a sea of fluctuating energy, having a rich physical structure, and governed by physical laws. So when he says there are different kinds of nothing, or that nothing has properties and so forth, that's a tip-off that he's misusing the word to use it as a term of reference to something rather than to mean not anything. And so what he is describing in every case is simply a physical system which undergoes a change from one state to another. And it does nothing to even address the question of why there is... And that's the proper use of the word. It does nothing. It does not do anything to address the question of why there is something rather than nothing.
Okay. He's not here to defend it, but that sounds pretty good.
Well, it is. I'm glad you mentioned that, because we just had three dialogues on this in Brisbane, Sydney, and Melbourne. He did not even raise a voice, not a word, to defend his claim that physics can offer a plausible explanation of the universe from nothing. I was really surprised about that. He just utterly was silent on that issue.
What do you put the new atheism and the... Atheism isn't anymore just this don't believe in God, get on with life. They're actually trying to get their message out very loudly and strongly.
Yes.
What's behind that?
Well, I think that the difference between the so-called new atheism and the old atheism, represented by the likes of Bertrand Russell and A.J. Ayer and others, is that the new atheists are not content to simply eliminate religion from the public square. They want to eliminate religion from society entirely, even from the private sphere. They want to see religious belief extinguished, even in the private sphere. And that's what makes them new and so aggressive. And as to why, I think that the rise of militant Islam in our day has partially served to fuel this, because they tar every religious believer with the same brush as Islamic jihadists, who want to use violence as a tool of religious propagation. And, of course, that's utterly contrary to the Sermon on the Mount. And it's incorrect to think that Jesus would ever sanction violence as a tool of religion. That was a mistake made by the medieval Crusades, by the Inquisition, and it's a mistake made by these Islamic jihadists as well. But these new atheists, don't have a very nuanced view of religion, and so they tar everybody with the same brush. And then I think, too, there's just a lot of personal anger there. They've probably had some bad experiences maybe in their church or as a young person, and there is a real emotional element to this that is just very apparent when you look at atheist websites and blogs on the internet.
Question to bring us back to the Bible. You said there were different ways to read Genesis 1.
Yes.
Could the same then be applied to the gospel accounts and the resurrection? Yeah.
This is
how do we therefore get to the accurate historical Jesus?
This is a very good question. What you're asking is a question in an area called hermeneutics. And hermeneutics is the science of literary interpretation. How do you interpret a piece of literature properly? And one of the key to hermeneutics, or correct interpretation, is to understand the type of literature that you're reading. For example, when you read the Psalms in the Bible, you're reading poetry. So when the psalmist says, "Let the trees of the wood clap their hands before the Lord," he's not teaching botany. You know, the psalmist doesn't think trees have hands. Don't lay that scientific error on him. It's poetry. Similarly, when you read Genesis 1, I think a good case can be made out that you're not reading a scientific account of the origin of the world, but a figurative account that isn't meant to be taken literally. And I say that not on the basis of modern science, but on certain clues in the text as to the type of literature it is. By contrast, when you come to the Gospels and Acts, the literary type that these resemble most closely is the type called ancient biography. These would be things like the lives of the Caesars or lives of famous Greeks and Romans by people like Plutarch. And these ancient lives have a historical interest in telling the facts about the hero that the biography is about. Now, ancient biography does differ from modern biography in some ways. They are typically not a story from the cradle to the grave of the hero in chronological order. Very often, ancient biography will relate anecdotes about the hero that are meant to bring out or illustrate his character or his greatness or his prowess in certain areas. And therefore, that reminds us that we need to be careful when we read the Gospels and not to press them too hard on chronology, because they may group things together thematically rather than chronologically. But nevertheless, the Gospels, as ancient biography, have a historical interest. They are not poetry. They're not hymnody. They're not Jewish apocalyptic literature, which could be very symbolic. These are of the genre of historical writing. And that, I think, gives us the clue that they intend these narratives to be of events that really happened, about people that really lived and places that really existed and can be archaeologically and historically confirmed as such.
How are we feeling? A couple more questions? Yeah, we're good? You're right for a couple more?
I am. This is fun.
Good. What evidence are other religions based on?
Well, this is a really interesting question, because there really aren't many other religions that claim to be historically based. For example, take Buddhism. Buddhism is basically a philosophy of life about how to get along without God in a world that is filled with suffering. How do you come to grips with suffering and manage to live a life in equanimity and peace? That's basically Buddhism. Taoism is a Chinese religion, is also a kind of pantheistic religion that isn't based on historical facts. Hinduism has mythological tales of Krishna, but these aren't historical. So most of the world's religions aren't historically based. Now, a contrast would be Islam. Islam claims to come out of the life of Muhammad, a real historical individual, and the revelations that he received from God. And I find it fascinating to look at Islam and what it says about Jesus and see how historically accurate it is. And it is stunning to me that the Quran, the holy book of Islam, gets wrong the one indisputable, universally recognized fact about Jesus, namely his crucifixion. Every historian, no matter how liberal or leftist, recognizes that Jesus of Nazareth met his end by Roman crucifixion. And yet, according to the Quran, and I quote, "They did not kill him, neither did they crucify him. It only appeared to them as such." So the Quran gets the central fact about Jesus of Nazareth wrong by denying that he was ever crucified. And what that suggests to me is that this religion, however, whatever truth it may have in affirming the greatness of God and that there is only one God, we can be one with them on the monotheism. I think that's great. And many of the things that the Quran says about God's exaltedness and how praiseworthy is, that's great. But it really gets it wrong about Jesus, I think. And that would be one reason I could not be a Muslim, but am a Christian.
Trying to do this on the fly, there's a few here that I think essentially saying, were people different 2,000 years ago? And I think part of this question, that maybe not as sharp as we are today, and have mixed myth, legend with fact.
Yeah.
How can we be sure 2,000 years on, as people that have pretty impressive, you know, technology, that these guys got it wrong?
Certainly folks were different in the ancient world, and especially I think in Judaism, they were open to God's existence and believed in God in a way that modern secular people do not. But that doesn't mean they were gullible or stupid, I think. And so I would say that there's no way around this question than to get your fingers dirty and look at the historical evidence and see how good it is. And as I say, when historians look at the New Testament Gospels, these emerge as very credible sources for the life of this man, Jesus of Nazareth. So that if you trust, for example, Plutarch and Arian for the life of Alexander the Great, you've got no good reason for not trusting the veracity of these authors who independently attest to facts in the life of Jesus of Nazareth. And that's why the majority of scholars agree with those five facts that I listed earlier in our conversation that I think go to undergird the resurrection of Jesus.
Someone's just sent a follow-up to your previous answer. If these religions don't have the same kind of evidence Christianity does, why do they continue to thrive and grow? And in at least our community right here, it would seem Christianity is diminishing.
Well, think about it. I mean, what do you think? Probably due to sociological factors. I mean, people raised in Muslim countries are raised in an overwhelmingly Islamic environment, and one tends to adopt the religion in which one was raised. So I would just say sociological factors would explain that. In fact, when Jan and I were in Turkey recently, and you walk about the streets and you hear the call to prayer going out over loudspeakers in the city, and you see all these beautiful mosques all around you, it hit me. I thought, if I were raised in this culture, it would be almost impossible just not to be a Muslim. It's just so overwhelming, the presence around you. So it's I think it's largely explained due to sociological factors. But that does nothing as to the truth of these religions. I mean, if you were raised in Nazi Germany, you probably would have been a member of the Hitler Youth and been a Nazi. But that doesn't mean that Nazism is therefore true, right? So the fact that people's beliefs are largely conditioned by where they were raised and live does nothing to reflect upon the truth or falsity of those beliefs. And I would say with regard to Christian theism, that we have very good grounds historically for thinking it's true. And I will engage in dialogues and debates with Muslim theologians about the evidence comparative for Islam and Christianity. And I think try to show that, in fact, the Christian faith has better evidential foundations than, say, Islam, not to mention Buddhism and Hinduism and these other religions of which we've spoken.
Maybe two more and then we'll wrap up. So Christianity is based on truth claims. What about those who never get to hear about those truth claims?
See, I think this is probably the hidden question that was lying behind that last one. Mm. If people raised in these Islamic countries overwhelmingly are apt to become Muslim, then how can God judge them, right? Because they're conditioned by the nations and condition in which they live. So what this is an argument for, it's not really an argument against God. It's not an argument against the resurrection of Jesus. Neither of those facts is affected by this question. If this is a problem, what would it prove? Well, it would prove some sort of universalism, wouldn't it? That God somehow saves everybody and that everyone is saved. So this really doesn't affect anything that we've talked about so far, namely the existence of God and his self-revelation in Jesus and his resurrection from the dead. This is a question about the scope of salvation, about the breadth of God's salvation. And what I would say, there's a lot to be said about this, and let me refer you to our website again, because it's hard to do this in a soundbite way. But on our website, there's a section devoted to the question of Christian particularism. That is to say, how can Christianity in particular be true, and what happens to these other folks? And here's my take on this. As I read the New Testament, it seems to me that God judges people on the basis of the light that they have. And that those who have heard the gospel of Christ will be judged on the basis of what they do with Christ. But those who have never heard the gospel will be judged on the basis of the light that they do have, namely the revelation of God in nature and in conscience. And if someone responds appropriately to God's revelation in nature and conscience, then God will apply to him the benefits of Christ's blood, even though that person doesn't have a conscious knowledge of Christ. He would be like people in the Old Testament, like Job, who never heard of Christ. In fact, Job wasn't even an Israelite. He wasn't even a Jew. He wasn't a member of the Old Covenant even. And yet Job clearly had a relationship with God. God called him my righteous servant. So how was Job saved? Well, he was saved through the blood of Christ, the death of Christ, even though Job had no knowledge of Christ. He responded to the light that he had, and God applied to him the blood of Christ. So I would say no one is going to get an unfair decision before the judgment seat of God. God will judge every human being based on the light that he has. Now, that doesn't answer the full problem, because we might say, well, what about someone who has never heard the gospel and so he's never heard the gospel, but he rejects the light of nature and conscience and so is lost, but who would have received the gospel and been saved if only he had heard it? And here's my take on that. I think that it's possible, given God's omniscience, that God has so providentially ordered the world that anyone who would freely embrace the gospel if he heard it is born at a time and place in history where he does hear it. So that anyone who wants or even would want to be saved will be saved. Now, is that true? I don't know. God knows. But as long as that's even possible, it shows that there isn't any inconsistency between God being all-loving and all-fair and some people never hearing the gospel and being lost. Now, I know that went by very quickly, but if you're interested in exploring that further, I go into this in great depth on the website in the section on Christian particularism.
And just lastly on that, there's a challenge for all of us, isn't there, in that we have heard the claims of Jesus.
Yeah, obviously.
We do have access.
We're responsible for what we've heard. And moreover, Jez, I would say this. We have the great privilege to carry this gospel to the unreached, knowing that God in his providence has so ordered the world that as we go out sharing the gospel, God will place in our paths people who he knew would freely respond to it if they heard it. So that there are literally divine appointments waiting for us out there of people whom God knew would freely respond to the gospel if we were to share it with them. And that is a tremendous incentive to be the bearer of the good news and to so help spread the gospel.
Hmm. I'll actually leave it on that one. That's a good note to end on. Friends, would you thank Dr. William Lane Craig?
Thank you.
We very much appreciate you taking time out to be with us this morning.
And
let me just wrap up by saying kind of what I've just said, that the things of Jesus are massive when you actually come to read him as an adult. I love having conversations with people looking into these things, but I often find they've only heard about Jesus, not actually gone to Jesus. So we would love to give you opportunity to do that with us here. We do that every week here at church, where you'd be welcome. We open up the Bible and see what it has to say. But also, let me point you to something. There's a slide I can bring up, something we're running in a couple of months' time called What God, where we will look at more of these evidences for why you could believe in the existence of God and he being the God of Jesus Christ. So that's coming up in October.